Next up is the section on implementation. But before we start, I do have to let Henry know of a new tradition in the FBSB. That is, if it's your birthday, you have to sing happy birthday.
I'll just leave.
Henry, I'm leaving
it
too.
Is Henry's job. Yeah. Okay, anyway, I don't know if it's
turn. I think okay. to matter.
Go ahead.
Hi. Today, the FASB staff and the IASB staff are going to be giving the boards an update on the status of their respective implementation efforts on revenue and leases. The IASB materials are included in 12A, and the FASB materials are included in 12B. There's also a cover memo number 12, which includes the discussion questions for the board that we'll get to after both staffs have presented their respective slides. So with that, we'll turn to 12B, which is the FASB slides. And here we've got an overview of where we are in terms of revenue implementation. So I'm on slide 3 to start, just a little snapshot of the timeline of where we are. So public companies in the U.S. calendar year end started applying the standard in January of 2018. And we have a one-year deferral for public companies. So public companies will be adopting in 2019. So they adopt for annual periods, and there'll be interim periods of 2020. So we're kind of in an interesting spot here, as you see in the timeline, in terms of we're doing post-implementation monitoring of the public companies. So those who have adopted, how is it going? And then we've also got the privates who are still gearing up for adoption, where we're still answering technical inquiries. And we'll share, as I go through the slide, some of the efforts on both the post-implementation monitoring and what we're seeing in terms of technical inquiries. On the next slide, number 4, here we've just got a brief summary of the resources that we have available for implementation. This is in the revenue section, but this also applies to the leases topic in terms of our overall resources. So, you know, a couple of things just to touch on here is, as you're aware, we had the transition resource group, which issued over 60 papers on mostly educational topics. We've got a technical inquiry service, which isn't unique to RevRec, but is a service that FASB provides to answer questions. And as I mentioned, we're still going through that process for public companies who aren't calendar year ends, who are still adopting this year, and then privates who are gearing up for adoption. We keep this as a regular agenda item for all of our advisory groups to check in on how things are going. And then we've had a focus on education. Here we've listed the FASB webcast. We do a lot of speeches at conferences. And in particular, over the last year, we've done a lot on investor education. So we did several webcasts and podcasts on a number of industries to help investors focus in on key changes to the standard. Moving on to slide 5, we just wanted to share here a little overview of the AICPA's process and our involvement with that group, because that's something that's unique to the U.S. implementation. So the AICPA had formed 16 industry task force groups to go through implementation of the standard and develop an accounting guide on RevRec. So these groups, you know, aren't setting any guidance, but going through common scenarios in their industries and seeing how the guidance applies to it. So the way it worked is that each industry task force worked through the issues. They feed the issues up to a revenue working group. So that's a group that's looking across all the industries for consistency as they're finalizing them to make sure that there's not, you know, inconsistent conclusions on issues on similar transactions. They ultimately went up to FinRec and got published in a revenue recognition guide. Now, in terms of FASB's involvement, we helped along with the process to the extent that there were implementation questions, whether it be a TRG submission or a technical inquiry along the way, to help move those issues along as they go through that process. And the AICPA has published that guide, about a 500-page guide with those implementation issues available on their website. Moving on to slide 6, in terms of implementation questions, just at a high level, you can see here on this slide with this chart, we had TRG really peaked in 2015, so right after the standard came out in the first year or two, we worked through most of those TRG issues. And then as you can see, we're continuing to answer technical inquiries, but as the adoption date has passed for a calendar year in public companies and is approaching for others, you'll see that there's been a drop-off in technical inquiries, but we're still fielding questions as those who are adopting are still going through that effort. On slide 7, I'm not going to go through this in detail, but just mentioning that we had a couple of improvements that we made to the standard that came out of the TRG process. These were all finalized in 2016, so we've been at a steady state for the last 2 years or so. We don't expect any other changes here, but just an overview of where we were on that. And then 8 and 9 give you a little bit of an insight into where we are in terms of our post-effective date plan and process. So We're trying to get some real-time data as companies have just adopted to see how things are going. On slide 8, you'll see this is the full plan. We're currently in year 1, getting early information on expected versus actual costs and trying to monitor investor perceptions to see early on benefits. So slide 9 has some of the early observations. So we've had some discussions year-to-date so far with our financial accounting standards advisory group and our small business advisory council to see how it went. Some of the early feedback at a high level was that the initial level of effort for transition was higher than expected. So we've had a lot of discussion with them about the need to review all contracts, monitoring internal controls, the importance of the documentation, that if, regardless of whether you have a recognition and measurement change, going through the process to see whether that is or is not the case. We saw that some of that feedback was that, you know, that process was a little quicker than expected, but there were benefits. So by going through contract reviews, companies were able to identify where they could improve internal controls or flag where they were using non-standard contracts, where they could start to align processes and try to standardize things. So benefits there. And then the last bullet, just overall less of an impact to IT systems than was expected. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Chris to go through the Lisa slides.
Sure. Okay. Thank you. So we'll start with slide E11, which is the status as to where we stand in some of the actions that the board has taken. As the first bullet says, there wasn't a TRG group for leases, but the board and staff, of course, stand ready to assist stakeholders as they implement the leasing guidance. To date, the board has held seven board meetings, most recently, which we'll get into, has resulted in some standard setting. And I will get into that as we move through the slides. So if we move on to slide 13, and I won't spend too much time here, this just gives you a broad overview of the types of inquiries that we've received. As you can see on slide 13, that the most significant topic has been transition. We do have a very complex transition as a result of the two lease classifications for lessees and so forth, and we'll get to more on that as we move ahead. Slide 14 just breaks down when you get into transition and scope and the level of inquiries that we've received, what they relate to. We're not surprised that for transition that it's the lessees and the practical expedience that have received the most attention. And then scope, of course, identifying a lease. Some think that how a lease is defined has changed a bit, so we have received some questions there. If we move ahead, we'll get into, I think, the more meat of what I'd like to get through today with you, which is standard setting, actions that the board has embarked on. The first one is minor, and but did provide some cost relief, and it was in relation to land easements. The board decided to provide transition relief to entities due to what the board learned was diversity in practice and how land easements are being accounted for. And what the expedient allows is for an entity to not evaluate under 842 land easements that existed or expired before the adoption of the new Lisa's guidance and those that were not accounted for as leases under topic 840. Under 840. These entities will continue to apply their current account counting to land easements, which may be PP&E, which may be in tangibles, or maybe just executory costs. However, when topic 842 is adopted, and entity will apply the new leasing guidance to all new land easement arrangements. That's slide 16. This past March, the board exposed in Q1 of 2018 two targeted improvements. One was a new transition option, which is consistent with one which is allowed in IFRS 16, whereby an entity would be allowed to adopt 842 with a cumulative effect adjustment in the period of adoption. Therefore, they would not have to account for the comparative periods they present in accordance with 842. This was proposed and affirmed in March with no real changes to what was exposed. This was proposed and affirmed in response to concerns that were raised by stakeholders as they ramp up to adopt the new leases guidance for public business and entities. We expect that to be on 1-1 of 19. The board also provided a practical expedient for lessors in regards to the separation and allocation guidance, whereby the board is going to allow lessors to not have to separate lease and non-lease components and account for them as a combined component if certain conditions are met. And with that, I'll move right ahead to slide 19, which gets more into what the conditions are and what the vote was. If the lease component and the non-lease component have the same timing and pattern of transfer, as well as if the lease component, if it were accounted for on its own, would be classified as an operating lease, the lease and non-lease components can be accounted for as a single component. So for those arrangements that are within the scope of the expedient, the board did vote as well that if the predominant component is the non-lease component or components, that you would account for the combined within within topic 606, the revenue guidance, and if not, you would account for the combined component as an operating lease. Right now, where we stand with this is we're expecting to go to ballot by the end of this week, and hope to issue these improvements by late next month. Lastly, there were another couple of issues that came up, related to lessors. The first has to do with sales taxes and other similar taxes, for example, and excise tax. Broadly, the new leases guidance requires lessors to report these taxes as lease revenue if the lessor is the primary obligor. The cost that were conveyed to us and what was to determine whether the lessor is the primary obligor or not. So the board decided to provide an accounting policy election to not report these amounts. We are in the midst of external reviewed the language on this and plan to go back to the board again next month to see if we can proceed on that. This is the same for the next slide 21, which is certain lessor costs paid directly by lessees on behalf of a lessor. The types of costs that we refer to here that were really brought up to us here were property taxes and insurance, which same thing paid directly by a lessee to a third party. These are under 8442. These are required to be reported most times as revenue with an offsetting expense, so report them gross. Lessors have claimed to us that estimating these costs is complex and that they don't see the benefit in doing so when the impact on the P&L is zero. Where it becomes complex as conveyed to us is when the cost is contains lessee specific factors. So, for example, for insurance costs, you could have all sorts of factors that are lessees but specific, such as the level of deductible, as well as that these costs may not be reported to the lessor from the lessee. The board decided that you would not have to report these costs gross when the uncertainty associated with these payments is not expected to be resolved. This concept is consistent with one that's been used in the REVREC guidance. But again, we're still trying to work on the words here to make sure that we scope this right. This also, along with the sales taxes, has been externally reviewed, and we plan to go back to the board on it. Last slide just talks about that we've gone final with a document which made improvements to our codification. The board did not expect the proposed changes that resulted from this project to have a significant effect on how 8.2 is applied. So I know that's a mouthful on what we've been doing, and I'll stop there and turn it over. I don't know if we're going to go to questions now or if we're going to let the ASB tee up their slides.
Thanks, Mary and Chris, Henry and Katrina.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So if we now turn to 12A, which is the other paper on the implementation activities. Just before getting into the specifics on revenue and leases, we just thought it would be helpful just to provide a little bit of context on the first three pages. So on page two, this is simply a diagram we've used quite a lot in presentations over the last couple of years, just to illustrate and emphasize the point that we're spending increasing amounts of our time supporting implementation. So the split, if you like, between standard setting research and on the one hand and implementation and maintenance on the other hand, it might not be quite the 50-50 as sort of depicted on the diagram here, but it's much more even between the two activities than it was in the past. And I think that just very much acknowledges that we always knew if we were going to reap the full payoff and the significant investment that the boards and our stakeholders made in developing the new standards, we were going to have to devote more resources to implementation support than we previously had done and get the standards off to a good start. So on page three, this really just explains what we think we're aiming to achieve in supporting our standards, and it sets out that how we see our objective is really about helping stakeholders get and obtain this common understanding of the requirements. In other words, it's all about really doing activities to help them have a common view about what they're aiming for when they're going about applying the new requirements in their own particular circumstances, which, of course, we then hope fosters consistent application amongst our various stakeholders around the world. So the focus is very much on enhancing and deepening the understanding of the new requirements. And then just very quickly on page four was really just a diagram to try and set out our overall approach to supporting a new standard after it's issued. And you can see on the left-hand side here, at the time of issuing a new standard, we provide overview information about the new standard in project summaries, effects analysis articles, etc. And then in the months after issuing the standard, we get into providing more detail, often in educational style materials. We use different, obviously, types of materials depending on the audience and the project, etc. But as the effective date comes closer, although we're still monitoring implementation and we will respond, for example, if we had a question into our interpretations committee, we become less active in producing public implementation materials. So as you can see on the bottom of the page, our aim is very much to be more active shortly after the standard is issued, because that's where we think we can be most helpful in explaining new requirements as companies are getting up the learning curve with those requirements. And it's also, I think, where we think our activities are the least disruptive, because later on, as you get further down the implementation process, obviously companies have made their decisions, they develop their systems, so we just need to be more mindful of the potential disruption to those implementation activities. So, you know, as we've got here, ideally in that final period before the effective date, we're aiming to try and provide a period of calm for implementation. And of course, I think we've very much learned from experience. So what you have on the slide here is the model that we're following on the new insurance standard, IFRS 17, and it's what very much followed on IFRS 16. And I think it was very much benefited from the earlier experience on the new revenue and financial instrument standard. So with that background, just hand over to Katrina to talk through some of the specifics on revenue and leases.
Thank you, Henry. So slide five really summarises the support we provided for the new revenue standard. And I suppose initially the main way of supporting that standard was via the joint TRG, so both the meetings and the papers prepared for that. And of course, as Mary explained, both boards also made some targeted clarifications to some of the principles in the standard back in 2016. Some of the other activities that, by the way, cut across both, you know, IFRS 15 and IFRS 16, all trying to support others in the sort of important role that they play in the context of the application of our standards. So we have had and do have some helpful conversations with national standard setters and regulators on questions that might have arisen in their jurisdictions. We also try to provide education to both regulators and investors and national standard setters. And also, though we don't have sort of a formal technical inquiry process, we do engage in sort of informal technical conversations in trying to support others in the role that we that they play. And also we find that quite useful, actually, because it's a helpful way of being informed about how implementation is going and helps us to work out whether we think there's any sort of implementation activity that we need to do to sort of support what's happening in practice. If I move on to slide six, that just really mentions sort of another avenue of support, which I suppose is via the Interpretations Committee process. And slide six sort of summarises some more recent discussions that the committee's had specifically around real estate contracts. So late last year, there were some questions submitted to the committee. After sort of in particular jurisdictions, the various stakeholder groups had been unable to sort of agree upon exactly how to apply IFRS 15 to real estate contracts. And I suppose some of the questions that came up, we always knew those particular requirements were going to be sort of very pivotal or very important to the real estate industry in those jurisdictions. So the result of the committee's work was really in publishing sort of educational-style explanatory material in what we call agenda decisions. We think the material is quite helpful in just pulling together in one place the sort of relevant requirements, provide some context by, you know, mentioning the underlying principles or objectives that sort of support those requirements. And this was tries in a way to relate to companies how they might think about walking through the literature, and it sets out maybe some of the questions they might want to ask themselves in working out how to apply the requirements to their particular contracts. Now, I think in considering these revenue questions, of course, we were very aware, of course, we're dealing with a converged standard. So I just want to mention, actually, it's been particularly helpful to be able to engage with Mary and her colleagues as part of the FASB staff, by the way, on these questions and very helpfully sort of throughout the process. If I move on to slide seven, which is on leases. And so slide seven sort of summarises how we supported implementation on IFRS 16. Because we didn't form a TRG in leases, of course, then the form of support has been slightly different, and I'll just highlight some of the main areas of difference. First of all, on leases, we did organise a number of dedicated conferences where there were kind of a whole day dedicated just to leases and talking about the standard. We got a number of board members to write articles, in particular talking about implementation and the sort of things that companies might want to start thinking about on that. And also we have got a couple of pieces of ongoing narrow scope standard setting that the slide mentions. One is a tweak to an illustrative example, and the other is actually, it's the question is really about the application of our taxes standard, IAS 12, but it's specifically in the context of recognising deferred tax associated with lease contracts. So that's all. Another thing to mention just in this slide is that even though there wasn't a TRG, of course, we were interested in still trying to monitor and being informed about implementation questions. So we did set up an email box on our website so that people could inform us about questions. And I think that was particularly helpful. If I move on then to slide eight, I suppose in mentioning what was the main way that we sort of provided support around IFRS 16. And that's slide eight sort of summarises the fact that we sort of developed a series of educational style webinars on leases. And I suppose linking back to what Henry said in terms of the approach, you'll see that we sort of invested quite a lot of time just after the standard was issued, so in the first half of 2016, to developing these kind of webinars, with the idea that that could be helpful to stakeholders when they're first looking at the requirements and sort of starting to familiarise themselves with what the new standard said. The other thing I'll just mention about these, of course, is that, as I say, that all of the meetings we had or the email box, in terms of the content of these webinars, just getting that input was quite helpful. So, for example, the webinars that there were on the exemptions and on lessee measurement, much of that content was based on questions we had received, about ongoing implementation activities. And actually, the webinar on modifications and on lease term in 2017, we developed solely because of questions we'd heard that was happening in practice. So they were developed just to try and support that. The final thing I'll say, maybe, what is that learned? I think for me, it kind of says actually that the more we can use our website, I think it's useful where we can, because it's a really good way of trying to provide all stakeholders with the same information. And I suppose rather than maybe standing up at a conference with just 100 people in the room, it's also a good way of just getting out to more people. And so, for example, until from issuing up until early May this year, there were over 26,000 views of this leases webinar series on our website, and also just our leases implementation webpage in total, there have been over 95,000 views of that page. So quite a good way of trying to communicate around the world.
So just finally, on page 9, of course, when the standards become effective, I know we always said revenue was special, and I know Patrina thinks leases is special, but in some respects they effectively become just like other standards that are already in effect. And so we have the Interpretations Committee process for dealing questions that arise. But of course, for these major new standards, we are particularly interested in monitoring the actual application of the standards in these first reporting periods. And so, as it says here, we're working with the regulators, audit firms, and national standard setters in doing this. And we'd like to do what we can to try to encourage improvements in application over these first few years of the new standard being in effect. Because I think the reality is that with such major change, whilst I think all of the work that's been done to date has really helped sort of narrow down the starting readings, where they would otherwise have been if we'd not collectively been doing these type of activities, application isn't going to be perfect on day one. So I think there's going to be, still work to do to encourage improvement in these initial periods. So that was all that we wanted to sort of say, but if we could sort of circle back, Russ, to the two questions on the cover note, and open it up for questions and any observations.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Are there any? Hal?
Oh, I think Jim was up ahead of me.
Just maybe a reaction on revenue, and I think, Mary, you talked about maybe some limited feedback that we got at FASAC about level of effort being more than maybe some expected. We'll certainly do more work, but I think that level of effort certainly paid off in terms of what appears to be a very successful implementation. I mean, we didn't, at least in the U.S., hear any noise in Q1 about, really unresolved issues that people were struggling with. I think we saw companies, maybe at least by best practice, doing education with their investors, before the reporting. And here's that effort. It at least looks like it's paid off in a successful implementation. It also looks, at very early stages, that it didn't result in higher levels of cost than perhaps anticipated. The numbers that are that people were talking about at FASAC, well, not trivial, and certainly don't want costs being spent in a way that's not productive. Here, I think, very successful, and at least for those that were talking about cost levels, I think for the size of companies would probably qualify almost as rounding errors if you were talking about financial reporting, and that's not necessarily the way to gauge the cost, but these were not high dollar numbers relative to size of entity. I've seen some surveys by some of the big four, and at least the initial amounts they have are, again, not in order of magnitude that I think anyone would think is out of proportion to the size of entity. Again, very early, but we're going to be doing, as Mary said, more gathering of that information as we go forward throughout this year and as we get into then more about what are the benefits vis-a-vis those costs.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to steal your graphic on four. That was the transition graphic or the support graphic. I think it's a good idea. We probably should have one just like that. So if you see it.
I'll take it as a compliment.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll pay a licensing fee. My question is more on page 18, Petrina. Excuse me, 8. I'm sorry, 8, yeah. Not 18. This was a year and a half-ish kind of education process, and I liked all the modules, but I keep hearing from companies as they develop their package and how they're going to implement a new standard, they want to put everything together up front and then schedule it out. Does it create a problem in having, like, the least, let's say, disclosure in July of 2017, over a year and a half after the standard came out? Did you have any concerns expressed by folks? You know, because I know that a lot of them want to integrate the disclosure with any other changes. And we heard that as we were developing the standard as well. So I was just wanting to understand the thinking, and would you recommend that we follow a module approach, stretch out over this length of time, or is there another way that we should be thinking about this?
So not necessarily. I think it's a good question, and I'll tell you what our initial plan was and then how it's materialized into this, I suppose, what I think is the question. So our initial plan was that obviously, you know, when we were working together and developing the standard, you know, there's areas where you that either have particularly new requirements or have got a lot of attention and we'll need to, you know, we think it would be helpful to develop modules on. So, for example, obviously we had, you know, in January the initial just introducing, but we had already, a staff and board together identified, look, transitions an area, and we'll do that first. Look, transitions, one of the first things you might need to think about, so we'll do transition. Definition of a lease is something, of course, we talked a lot about. We'll do that next. We wanted to talk about the exemptions. We wanted to talk about measurement, and we also had disclosure on the list. And so in terms of what our initial thinking was, we had transition, definition, exemptions, measurement, disclosure sort of identified. And so our initial thought was that we would do it all as early, you know, as we could, and our initial plan was almost to do those, you know, in 2016, you know, over a slightly phased period, in a sense, that sort of in the first, say, you know, up until sort of Q3 2016. What, you know, materialized as we had, you know, our email box and as we were speaking to people initially. So first of all, we got a bit more input in terms of the exact content of some of these, and I particularly highlighted the exemptions and lessee measurements. So we expanded some of the content, you know, of those depending on what we're hearing in implementation. Also, in particular, as it headed into the second half of 2016, what we started to hear was sometimes the people were saying, that's all great, we like them, but I'm not even thinking about this yet. And we started to hear some feedback that says, well, maybe it would have more, you know, punch, I might say, or more effect if we could put out some of the modules more closer to when people would be doing it. So I think you're right to say maybe for some people they'd want to developing the disclosure, but we kind of started to hear in 2016 that maybe it was a bit too early for disclosure. People were still going through the process of finding all their contracts, working out maybe, you know, the definition, what was lease or not, etc. And it almost was too early for disclosure. And in the meantime then, we could see that there were some other questions coming in more about the recognition and measurement. So, for example, on modifications, that was one where we could see there was a number of questions around that area. That was something new, wasn't an IS 17. So then we spent our time more dealing with what we were hearing more on the ground as being what were the implementation questions. So I suppose our initial plan wasn't necessarily to have it spread out well into 2017, but it was more both that March modifications on October 2017, they were both sort of to try and be responsive to intelligence where we were hearing that at that time, and the consequence for a disclosure was that because we were told almost 2016 was too early for a lot of people on disclosure, we ended up doing it in 2017.
Thanks.
Ginger.
Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for the presentation with regard to the implementation of FFCB's revenue and VC standards. I have two questions, one for revenue standards, one for lease standards. I'm very interested in that AICPA formed 16 industrial task forces to develop new accounting guidance, and also FSB are monitoring their activities. So during that process, I'm wondering whether there are any inconsistency or different understanding of the standards come out, and how you deal with those inconsistent or different understanding of those principles set out in the standards. I ask question one by one, yeah.
Sure, maybe sure, I can start just to put it in context. So the AICPA historically, years ago, used to be the standard setter in the U.S. before the FASB, and they created accounting and auditing guides by industry. So these 16 industry task force, that they were already in place, and they needed to do this to update what are commonly used tools called accounting and auditing guides. It has the accounting and help companies audit within an industry. And then Mary can talk about how we work with them.
Yeah. So in terms of inconsistencies, they had their process, orchestrated in a way to identify those. So there were certainly things that got through the industry task forces where the task force members might have come to a conclusion, but then when it moved up the chain, the revenue working group was able to go in and say, this industry is inconsistent with this other industry, and it would send them back to go look at it again. In terms of our involvement, we would get the questions when there was disagreement. So, if there were task force members that couldn't agree on what an answer was, or those areas of inconsistency that the working group identified, they might submit a technical inquiry or a TRG submission. But I guess, by the time it gets through their full review process, there shouldn't be any inconsistencies by industry. I don't think there's any areas where we've seen broad inconsistencies. It's kind of the process worked well.
Mary, I think it's safe to say, though, that there are a number of areas where they said there is more than one view, that they were trying not to establish GAAP. They're trying to talk about how to apply GAAP to prevalent transactions in industries. And so sometimes the perspective of the people around the table said that the standard is not clear enough to say there is a uniform single answer that has to be applied by all. That so when you say inconsistencies, I think it's across industries. You may see inconsistency in practice because of interpretations of the standards, which could be a useful tool for, the Interpretations Committee internationally and for EITF, hopefully some way coordinating that so that we continue to be consistent.
You had another question?
Yes, good. Yes. Same thing. And the second question was regarding to the lease standards. I noticed that FSB proposed the practical experience for lessors to not separate lease components and non-lease components. And once the non-lease components predominant component, then it will apply to revenue standards, as I understand it. So I'm not sure how to make judgment whether it is that component is predominant or not, what kind of criteria you developed, or whether there are any threshold you developed. I just want to ask details about that. Yeah.
So it's Chris here. So what we learned was that that for the most part that it should be a qualitative assessment whereby you can look at the magnitude of the value that's brought by one or the other of the components. So let me, like, let's take an example. If you look at a cable company who basically just gives you a box and then provides you with the surface of, you know, what shows that you want to watch or what have you, it wouldn't be hard for them to conclude, at least from what we've learned, that the predominant or more than predominant component there would be the service that they provide. But really, in the guidance that we propose, what we're saying is that you look at the component that the customer would ascribe more value to. So it's not perfect. We don't have a set quantitative test per se, but we are hoping that it's clear when the assessment is done as to what the customer would ascribe more value to, that is the piece of equipment being leased or the surface that the lessor provides.
It's also a practical expedient. So if you're spending too much time figuring it out, perhaps you shouldn't be in the practical expedient.
Mary?
I've got an observation and then a question to see if you've heard anything more that lines up with this. And I'm looking particularly at the slide in the FASB deck, slide 9, that Jim referenced in his earlier comments about feedback from FASEC, et cetera. You know, one thing, we've had several meetings recently where we've been trying to pull together, liaison meetings, pull together the information we're hearing about implementation of the new standards and compare notes with others, including, for example, regulators. That's us giving them our views. And I think generally consistent with what you heard from FASEC here, what we have heard along the way. There's one thing I want to comment on, but I particularly wanted to reinforce about the need to review all contracts, even if there's no recognition and measurement effect. Certainly what we're hearing, what I have heard from a qualitative perspective, particularly with respect to the revenue standard, is that there's a much better awareness within the business as a whole of the accounting consequences of some of the terms that might be agreed at, you know, during the negotiations, and thinking about that on a real time basis, the thing that I think we've also heard from users is about some disappointment in disclosures, and this is generic, a kind of across revenue and for us financial instruments as well, and maybe foreshadowing leases, both with respect to quantitative information about the expected impact before the period in which it's mandatorily effective, and then in the year of transition, whether there is enough information for a user to be comfortable that they are understanding the separate impacts of the change in accounting from what is happening with the operations in that year. And so as we think about how we get, you know, Henry mentioned we want to do disclosures. Sorry, we want to look for how to get improvements afterwards, not in a kind of punishment mode, just what, you know, what have we learned, where could we do better? I think disclosures on an ongoing basis, not just about the transition, because I think for the revenue standard in particular, your recognition and measurement may not change much, but the disclosures are supposed to give you a much deeper insight, you know, preaching to the converted here, in terms of your products, your businesses, you know, how you're earning your money. And if we didn't see the kind of uptick in disclosures that we were looking for in terms of expected impact and then transition, I hope that, you know, maybe if we keep messaging, we'll get something somewhat better for the year end. And then that may be a focus of how do we get disclosures that are more company-specific, not boilerplate about the requirements of the standard, but how do the requirements of the standard marry up with an entity's business model? So after that little soapbox speech, kind of going, you know, Mary, maybe particularly to you, what are you hearing about users' perceptions of disclosures to date about both the transition requirements and, about the effect of the forthcoming standard in the year of transition? And are you guys doing any messaging around expectations for the first year, disclosures for the first year on the new standards? Because I'm concerned about mediocre practice getting embedded as acceptable. And disclosure was one of the big wins with revenue.
Yep, sure. So in terms of the post-implementation monitoring, the advisory groups we've had to date have been more focused on auditors and preparers. We actually have next week a meeting with our investor advisory council. So during that discussion, we're going to try to elicit some early feedback on what they're seeing and what their reactions are to the disclosures. I think in terms of those who have adopted it, it's kind of early to get the data. The bulk of the company filings were just in May, so we're on a little bit of a lag waiting to see what that feedback is. We have looked at some of the early adopters at their disclosures to see what they're doing. And in terms of messaging, we're continuing to message disclosures are important. And it's interesting, too, there's been a number of, third-party analysis out there of the SEC's review of the early adopters and what their perception has been or their feedback on the questions on disclosures and where companies might adjust disclosure. So it's something we're certainly monitoring. I think it's just, it's tough in the early stages for those who have adopted. In terms of the SAB 74 disclosures, which is the expected adoption effect, we also monitored those, and I think we saw, early on they were lagging a bit, but as companies got to their year-end filings, they're a bit more robust. But certainly there's been a variety of, those companies who have done a great job in terms of having robust disclosure on what the effect is and investor calls to kind of walk through all the changes versus those that are more boilerplate, and we'll continue to monitor that and see how it progresses over the year.
Yeah, and my comments, first of all, are more anecdotal comments than study-based. There have been a couple studies, and the one I'm thinking of was probably more in the financial instruments area than in the revenue area. But, it is anecdotal and also, reporting a spread, but maybe some disappointment that there isn't a higher average performance.
I just add one thing about the disclosures, Mary. I mean, just to sort of say that one of the things we've been trying to do in any investor sessions, education sessions, is very much saying to them, look, this is what you should expect to see. You have a right to see this information. If you don't see it, please ask for it, because I do think that's an important way of getting that message out, as well as there's a user impact.
Anything else? Yeah, Mark.
On that note, I would also say what I've heard is mixed reviews on the disclosures so far, Mary, but also anecdotally, I will say that a couple of companies have done an extremely good job of highlighting the change, and in particular, one thing that I would say about the companies that highlighted the change pretty well is that they believe that the new model actually better reflects the economics of what they were doing, and so they were doing, in the past, they might have been doing a non-GAAP measure under our old revenue standard, and now they were getting rid of the non-GAAP measure because they think this better reflects it. And a couple of those companies that I'm thinking of did a very good job of highlighting the change and the difference, particularly because they thought it was a better reflection of the economics anyway.
This is especially the telecom sector, isn't it?
The one that I'm thinking of is not the telecom sector, as a matter of fact.
It's software. Yeah. Okay, anything else on leases and revenue? All right, well, I'll turn it back to you, Hans.